the national scene and what it all means. David Birdsell, Mark Steen of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and International Affairs, talking about the fantastic Brute College. David joins us for a couple. Sir, how are you? Hope you had a good weekend.
Great weekend, Jay. Wonderful to be here this morning.
Great having you. You know that. So this is a big week, and especially on Wednesday, as I just pointed out to the audience, you're going to have Joe Biden hosting his first meeting with Republican and Democratic leaders, House and Senate, since taking office. A little bit of a wrinkle into this is what I had suspected as far as the jobs report, the 266,000 or so new positions added in April. That's a quarter of the number analysts had expected, David. So that's going to be a topic of conversation without question here because, you know, we already know there's a lot of division here. And now it's about assumptions and what to do and what not to do as far as some of these reports. But that's going to be a fascinating day with Kevin McCarthy and company in the White House with Joe Biden there. That's going to be an interesting discussion, I would think.
It will be a very interesting discussion, although I think we already know some of the broad talking points, at least in outline form. What the Republicans are arguing about the jobs report is that it's proof that the level of public relief is stamping down the appetite for people to return to work. What the Democrats are arguing is that that's not the case at all, that it underscores the need for that aid, and that one of the major problems that we have is people not failing in their desire to work, but having genuine concerns over the safety of return to the workplace, particularly in certain high-exposure professions, such as food service, which has had a devil of a time getting people back to work for a host of reasons, many of them having to do with worker safety. And this gets us right back to some of the major talking points of the last several months, which is our march toward herd immunity, now broad skepticism in the medical community that we're going to get there, given the number of people who are still vaccine hesitant, and that clearly plays into the jobs report indirectly, but in ways that are very, very important for economic recovery, at least in the near term and maybe longer than that.
Good point. You know, everything has kind of a domino effect here. So, you know, that's going to be interesting. Now, the president is on tour right now. His big push is to secure bipartisan support for his infrastructure package. And you have a lot of folks returning to the Hill. You had a recess going on there. So besides the hosting of leaders of both houses, as far as Republican and Democrat, where do you think this infrastructure deal goes now in the next couple of weeks? $5.7 trillion, you know, on the table between the relief plan, this plan, the jobs plan. So, in essence, where do you go as far as the infrastructure is concerned here?
I'm interested in, I mean, clearly we once again, as in the other large bills, the ARP, of course, the American Rescue Plan being the one that has been $1.9 trillion signed and passed, argument about scale. And I have no idea where this is going to come down at the end of the day on scale. But I think we see an important indication of some willingness of Republicans to move forward, not only with the group of 10 relatively centrist Republicans who are planning to work with Democrats like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to try to craft smaller bills, but what they are doing individually is trying to carve out infrastructure spending in their districts, which is, of course, the pattern that Congress had historically followed for centuries, really, before the widespread reaction in the Tea Party Revolution against earmarks and other forms of bring home the bacon politics. This is a lot of bacon, and a lot of people want to bring it home. And this may well be the wedge that opens up broader possibilities for cooperation, because it's very clear to everybody, whether a voter in a district or a sitting legislator, that there are many, many needs at home that have to do with infrastructure, however you want to define that term.
No question. David Birdsall with us. Let's go to, you know, you're keeping an eye on this pipeline hack, David, where you had a cyber attack forced the shutdown, one of the largest U.S. pipelines over the weekend. And, of course, now everybody's citing a criminal group originating from Russia to blame here. So that's another aspect of this whole thing. But this is a reason for concern because of the gas prices. You know, you have this Colonial Pipeline. It transports more than 100 million gallons of gasoline or other fuel daily from Houston to the harbor here in New York. And we're talking about pausing of operations now after this attack. So how long the shutdown, who knows, but we could see a spike in gas prices. And even more so, it's about security vulnerabilities now that exist in the infrastructure in and around. So that's even more reason of concern here. So it's going to be interesting to see how we handle a lot of different ends of this thing in the next couple of days, you know?
Absolutely. And this is scary stuff. And while the price spike is important, as you say, you're quite right that the longer-term implications are the ones we should be more concerned about, which is the security of our energy distribution infrastructure. We're looking here at oil, a pipeline thousands of miles long. There are, of course, physical vulnerabilities with something of that size because you can't guard every foot of a 5,000-mile-long pipeline. You consider all of its eddies and offshoots. But the cyber management is even more concerning because that was clearly very, very porous. It was relatively easy for the hackers to get into the corporate data. They're taking a dual approach. On the one hand, a ransomware denial of access to data, but also threats now to take those data and publish them online. So it reveals our critical reliability on private firms. Colonial Pipeline is entirely private. It has no government financing or support of any sort. But they are responsible for the lion's share of the oil that reaches us from the Gulf. So really concerning. Take Colonial Pipeline and multiply it by as many firms as there are out there. We are very, very vulnerable when it comes to our standards. The Biden administration is following up with an executive order to be issued sometime very soon, perhaps as early as late this week, that will speak to this issue of trying to coordinate a national response against cyber attack. But again, that it's not up to the government alone. Much of private industry has to be able rapidly to shore up its own operations in self-interest, but in the interest of everybody who's reliant on their products and services.
And then the other aspect, David, what do you do here? And, you know, if Russia is at the center of this thing, now listen, we know with the elections and everything else, but now, as you say, if you are interfering in the energy distribution of this country, that is a serious infraction here. So what do you do? I mean, if you're this administration, how do you handle this right now in Russia? I mean, this is serious stuff here. So how do you go about your business now as far as, you know, everything else is concerned? But now you got Russia. You know, he's got his hands full with Russia and China here. So how does Biden handle Russia right now?
Hard to say. Just one note at the top, we're still early in investigating whatever is going on with Colonial Pipeline, but the early indications are that this is not a state-sponsored attack, but rather a criminal gang. And there can be some porous barriers between criminal gangs and states in the countries such as Russia, which are often willing to make use of government-aligned but not explicitly governmental resources in order to carry out attacks, even while reserving the most sophisticated attacks for units in the GRU. But that said, even if it's not a government-sponsored attack, it is an attack emanating from a country that is either unable or unwilling to police this kind of activity within its borders when the targets are outside of Russia. So the Biden administration does have significant concerns. And of course, it's not only Russia. It's China, it's North Korea, it's Iran, other countries with sophisticated digital workforces and very advanced hacking operations. With regard to Russia specifically, the question becomes, I think, to a certain extent, how much pain are you willing to enforce on the Russians to let them know what might happen if they continue down their own governmentally sponsored cyber attack route, or the lax operating environment for private criminal gangs, as appears to be the case in the Colonial Pipeline instance. What do you do? Do you bring down a portion of their energy infrastructure? Do you sequester accounts for leading Russians, not necessarily through the sanctions protocol, which has been in use for years and years, but by actually shutting them down digitally by going into the into those financial institutions and perhaps into government computers? That would be a significant escalation of this conflict, but it's certainly an option that's on the table, and it's been hinted at by Biden administration officials that there will be an appropriate and parallel response in time. It may already have happened, and we don't know about it, and that's the last point that I'll make. All of this can go on in the dark until it comes out into the public, such as the Colonial Pipeline case, when people can see immediately the results of a hacking operation. So it's a little hard to follow, and some of it would fall into the most clandestine activity of U.S. intelligence agencies, and it may be a long time before we know exactly what's on the table and indeed what has already happened.
Deb Bertzel with us. Now, you mentioned a key word here, response. And I'm just wondering, when do we get a response of some kind here regarding? Now, listen, I'm talking about the shootings over the weekend. More headlines, six killed at a birthday party in Colorado Springs yesterday. You also had the Times Square incident where two women and a four-year-old, they were injured in a shooting. They'll be fine. But I look at overall gun violence, especially in the city, David. I mean, it's off the charts right now. You have an 83%, I think that's the number now, 83% rise this year compared to the same period last year. That's an issue. Even at some other spots over the weekend, I think in Missouri I read two people killed, three others injured. At a park, gunfire erupted there. Even one in Arizona, you had an incident in Phoenix where one was killed, several injured. He had an altercation at some hotel. You know, you get to the point now where you become immune to this stuff. But on the other hand, you got to wonder what our lawmakers are figuring out here, if anything, because, you know, we know it's all talk, no action after these, you know, same thing. So in essence, do they come together? Do they get anything done regarding this? Or where do you think we end up with this stuff?
I'm an optimist by nature, but I'm afraid on this topic, I'm something of a pessimist. And my pessimism took firm hold after the Sandy Hook killings now 8 years ago. If that horrific example of more than two dozen dead school children at the hands of an emotionally disturbed man with an AR-15 couldn't convince people that you needed to get rid of semi-automatic military-style rifles, I just don't know what will. There is a cascade of horror mounting in this country on a weekly, if not a daily basis. And as you pointed out, just with all of the all of the different states and localities that you name checked there, it's not a phenomenon happening in any one place. It's happening everywhere. And the need for national legislation, in my view, is very clear. The consensus around the country is overwhelming. There is majority support above the 80 and for many actions such as strengthening the background check regime, red flag warnings, et cetera, above 90% in the population and very substantial majorities of gun owners. But this debate is being driven, as it has been for 30 years now, by Second Amendment absolutists who will brook absolutely no restriction on gun availability, regardless of type, regardless of purpose, regardless of the condition of the individual who is making a purchase based on prior criminal records or anything else. And it needs to stop, but I don't see what's going to shake loose the logjam other than massive popular outrage, which people feel but have yet to demonstrate in the ways that, heavens, even the Tea Party Revolution of 2009 or the Black Lives Matter movement of 2020 and before, and they actually began in 2014. But the massive protests last year, we haven't seen the same kind of popular energy around gun violence. That's number one. And number two is that there's a, you know, in addition to the availability of guns, there is an independent movement in many major cities of crime, particularly of shootings upward. It is a stark increase. You gave the figure a moment ago, 83% over last year. It is important to remember, though, that was 83% over a very, very historically low point in the period immediately prior to the pandemic. So that right now in New York City, and any shooting is one shooting too many. But we are now roughly back at the level we were in 2010 of shootings, which was the third Michael Bloomberg term, which not too many people saw as a pinnacle of crime. Of course, crime was, you know, that number was a number we were welcoming going down, and now it's going up at that same number. Deep cause for concern, but that's different than just the availability of guns overall. Last point. Is that this has attracted the attention of mayoral candidates in New York. And it may have been difficult for people to imagine if we were having this conversation in August 2020 that the two top contenders for the mayoralty in this city would be arguing against defunding the police and talking about strategies to more effectively police against gun violence. But that's exactly what Andrew Yang and Eric Adams are doing right now.
So whatever they're thinking, you must... You know, you have to point to some of the bail reform stuff. I mean, a case in point is the serial synagogue destroyer, that Jordan Burnett, you know, who went on a spree, you know, 42 counts and everything else, and he's back out on the street. You know, I mean, listen, somehow, some way, they got to figure it out. And that's part of the reason here, because when you're taking police off the streets – and everything else, when you're canceling units and everything else, when you're taking individuals off the street, you're making it less safer. And that's what's happening. That's why you're seeing the rise. I mean, it is right there in front of everybody. And that's what makes this thing so frustrating. The fact is that we have such division, not only on the national stage, but it's a trickle-down effect, as I've been saying all along, even into how states conduct their business. How New York is conducting their business regarding crime is deplorable. That's what you're seeing, why you have the elevation of these numbers. I mean, it's unbelievable. 83% jump from a year prior. What does that tell you? And a lot of it is because they cannot incarcerate these people based on the judges that do not have the power they once had to hold these individuals, David. That's fact right now. So, you know, there's a lot of exploring to be done here.
Absolutely. And let's not forget pandemic, which is a factor here as well. There was a humanitarian movement. It's not over yet to remove people believed not to pose a threat of violent crime, or at least a vastly reduced threat of violent crime, to let them out of prison prior to the emergence of the vaccines, because prison was a near certain recipe for getting COVID, true of inmates and true of prison guards as well, by the way, which is also a population which has experienced staggering percentages of COVID infection and elevated death rate. And think about, if you wanted to create a human petri dish for COVID infection, you couldn't do much better than most of our prisons. And that's a factor here, too. But it should be the case, again, if we get to that herd immunity level, if we get everybody to get a jab in the arm, it has implications for law enforcement, as well as for everything else that we've talked about with regard to the economy, schools, et cetera.
And listen, New York's done a good job as far as mine. I think it's 60% of adults now have gotten at least one shot. The national stage, there's plenty of hesitancy. You know, Biden's goal is what? 70% of adults by July the 4th? I don't know.
Yep.
That's up in the air. And the thing that bothers me is, again, race against time, as I've been saying. It's variant against vaccine. Now, look what's happening in India here. It's off the charts, okay, with the... I think it's 2.75% of their population fully vaccinated only. 2.75%. Think about that. 1.3 billion population in India, that is an issue. And also what's happening in Japan as far as their vaccine rollout. Not going as quickly. I look at the Olympic Games, which is going to have is supposed to happen July 23rd. I mean, who knows there? But these are all factors as far as how our country is doing right now. And that's an issue because forget about herd immunity and everything else. Right now you have a hesitancy going on. You also have people after one shot not coming back for their appointments for shot number two, which is a major issue here. So these are all factors regarding the vaccine and where we're at in time as far as what's happening around the world, too. These are big factors that you have to take in as far as the equation is concerned. And that's something you got to look at right now, Deb.
But you look domestically, and there's tremendous regional variation in vaccination rates. And, you know, I'm overgeneralizing here, but in broad strokes, there are a number of rural areas of the country which tended to be heavily Republican registered and tended to vote for Donald Trump. And, of course, there was a lot of Donald Trump did receive a vaccine and has told people, although he has not made a big point of trying to trumpet this message, that they should get vaccinated. Let's be fair about that. But there was also a lot of vaccine misinformation that came out of that source. And those are the areas of the country, by and large, which have the lowest vaccination rates, together with some of the poorest areas in the country. And I'm thinking about in the Deep South, in Alabama and Mississippi, in heavily rural, largely black populations, which are also relatively more hesitant. The public information campaign has been more focused on those latter communities. And now what has to happen, and that's shown some success, because you've also had public health services out in the field finding ways to bring the vaccine to people who might be reluctant for whatever reason to get it, and more successful in persuading them to do so. But those rural areas particularly, I'm thinking about the rural Midwest and Northwest of the country, those are places where we have lots and lots of work to do, and it's important that messengers trusted by those communities, and I'm thinking about pastors, I'm thinking about family doctors, they're going to be important parts of pushing us to that 70% goal, which, by the way, is still a low bar for herd immunity in the minds of many epidemiologists. And the worldwide situation is just astonishing. I mean, you know, right now the only countries that are at 50% or hovering around that number or above are Qatar, Israel, England, and the United States. And everybody else is lagging behind.
No question. Something you got to keep an eye on. Sir, always a pleasure to have you know that. We'll keep an eye on things. We'll talk to you soon. David Burtzell. Doing the job as always. You stay well now, all right?
You too, Jay. Thanks for having me today.